You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the UK's Defence Minister quits to forestall further revelations about past misconduct. Will he and should he be the last? My guests Quentin Peel and Stephanie Bolzen will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Angela Merkel's continuing dominance of Forbes' annual list of the world's most powerful women, France's lifting of its state of emergency or extension of it under another name, and would you step on a pre-flight scale if Finnair asked you nicely? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow at Chatham House and contributor to the FT, and Stephanie Bolzen, the London correspondent for Die Welt. Welcome both. I did the double VW overlap thing there. Before we start with the programme proper, I just did want to get a very quick thought from each of you. Quentin, I'll ask you first about recent developments in the ongoing Catalonian circus. Eight of the sacked ministers have now been remanded in custody by a Spanish court, and prosecutors have now asked the judge to issue a European arrest warrant for Carles Puigdemont, the former president, who is presently holed up somewhere in Belgium.
Well, I think that it follows in a line of Madrid appearing to overdo the heavy-handedness in dealing with this. At the same time, I don't think that one should be overwhelmingly sympathetic to the Catalan ministers, who knew they were breaking Spanish law when they went ahead with the referendum, when they insisted on calling for this independence vote, and they've pushed this whole thing through without any clarity at all that there's anything like an overwhelming majority of their citizens who want independence. So I'm afraid that at the moment both sides are still making a mess of this.
Stephanie, is this Madrid deciding that its best way forward is to go by the book to attempt to uphold the rule of law?
I think this is what has been the Spanish, say, motto in the last weeks, and they are not changing their way of approaching the Catalan referendum. And I think, while if you look back in 2010, it was a big mistake what the Spanish government said, but not stretching out the hand and saying, okay, now we have to work on reforms of the statutes of Catalonia, and they missed that train. What they are doing now is following their laws, and the Catalan independence are breaking the law constantly. So I absolutely have very little sympathy with them going to jail. This is, they have broken the law and they have to go to jail.
Okay, well, there'll be more on that story, doubtless, on tonight's Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. For now, we will stay in the UK, which has a new defence minister and an uncertain number of extremely nervous other senior politicians on both sides of Parliament. Sir Michael Fallon, previous custodian of the defence portfolio, resigned yesterday, apparently to spare himself and the government the embarrassment of further revelations about his conduct towards women over the years. Fallon has been replaced by former Chief Whip Gavin Williamson, a move which appears to be dividing fellow Tory MPs between those who loathe this appointment and those who hate it. But Fallon, will he be the last to go? And if he isn't, then what? Stephanie, I'll ask you first, is there a similar phenomenon? Because this is all obviously happening in the wake of the revelations about the conduct of Harvey Weinstein, which appear to have had an extraordinary ripple effect across countries and across businesses and across industries and across politics. Is anything like this happening in Germany?
No, not yet. I mean, you should always be careful, because it can happen any time, as we know, and we're just witnessing here in the UK, and it can get an amazing speed. In Germany, back in 2013, we had the so-called Dirndl scandal, which was the then Minister for Business, Rainer Brüdele, from the Liberal Democratic Party. He apparently made a silly comment to a journalist as well, saying she had actually very nice breasts and she should wear a dirndl. So why don't you wear a dirndl? It would suit you very well. And she published it. And that caused an outcry. And actually, there was also a hashtag created. Now it's Me Too, the hashtag, mm-hmm. the famous one. Then it was called Aufschrei in German, which means outcry, I should say. And then there was a big debate about sexual harassment in political circles and beyond, of course, in business. And Brüderle, at the end, this minister, he had to go. And I always think it's a good debate to be had. I think it's now a good debate. Of course, people are saying this is a witch hunt, but I don't agree. And I do not agree neither with the journalist that defended Michael Fallon. I don't think she said she was actually wanting to protect real victims, but I thought she made it too easy for certain kind of men in these circles to get away with things.
Michael, as I was saying, sorry, not Michael, that's the minister. You're Quentin.
I prefer not to have his job.
Well, exactly. This is what happens when I try to remember more than three names at once. Quentin, as I said, that there will be a lot of extremely nervous men of a certain age on all sides of UK politics right now. Should they be feeling nervous? Do they deserve to be feeling nervous?
Well, I think they probably should, because I think that I'm not surprised that there seems to be quite a culture of sort of more than sexual innuendo. It's actually sort of people in power abusing their position and in the expectation of getting some response from young women who work for them or whatever. They've set the bar pretty low in the case of Michael Fallon on the face of it.
As far as we know. I mean, I think there's a lot of suggestion and I mean, his own resignation statement seems to suggest that the story that we have heard is very much the least of it.
Yes. I mean, the irony is, of course, this is a man who's been regarded up to now as a safe pair of hands.
So it to
perhaps
speak.
Gives a slightly different
that
meaning.
He was sociable. So he was one of those ministers that when you were going with him on a trip to a foreign country on the way back on the plane, he would say, oh, okay, let's open the bar and have a beer. So he was sociable, and then apparently at occasions he couldn't handle his own level of alcohol. This is what they say. But I mean, I get really wound up about this, because it is, I have experienced these things as well, being a journalist many years ago, not recently, but I think we got to speak up, because they just get away with it. And it makes me absolutely furious that you think, oh, yeah, well, I touched her a bit. And you know what this does to women? It's absolutely awful. You absolutely feel abused in that very moment. And when I experienced that, I was old enough, but I was thinking of younger females in the same situation who were maybe dependent on that person and would be forced to do things they wouldn't want to do, and you never get over this in your life. So I think, no, you gotta stop this and not say, well, don't bother. This was just a bit of a joke. It's not a joke.
What do you think has changed, though? Or, I mean, what better question is, what is different about the revelations about Weinstein? Why has that story been the one that has brought out so many, 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 many other stories?
Well, first of all, I think just the Weinstein story is so absolutely horrendous. I mean, the dimension of Weinstein has been so shocking that it liberated fears, I think. And then, of course, there were so many women who are so famous who went out, and women who would absolutely credibly testify what had happened to them. And it's just another point. I mean, these things, these scandals come again and again, don't they, though?
So you don't think, Stephanie, that we've always slightly worried that the British are obsessed by sex and sex scandals, whereas in France, in Germany, people took it more normally. But actually, in this case, you feel, no, it isn't that the British are obsessed by sex. It's right to have a scandal.
I'm not even sure, but is this a sex scandal, though, or a sexual harassment scandal?
I think it's more sexual harassment.
They're two very different things.
Yes,
it's how you treat women. It's how you understand treating women. And by the way, you said men of certain age. I'm not so sure it is only among certain age.
Depressingly, I suspect you're right. just a final quick thought on this one, Quentin. Is this potentially the kind of thing that brings down government?
Well, it is, I think. And this government is looking incredibly accident-prone. It seems to be crashing into every conceivable pothole. And this is just the latest. So it makes Theresa May look just appallingly weak.
Okay, well, let's move along now. It has been observed many times before that Germany's Chancellor, Angela Merkel, increasingly resembles the only reliably fixed point in a crazily fluid political landscape. That position has been reinforced by the release of the 2017 iteration of Forbes' list of the world's 100 most powerful women. Chancellor Merkel holds the top spot, as she has every year since 2006, aside from one uncharacteristic fourth-place finish in 2010. Stephanie, there's not really any argument against this, is there? I mean, it's if you're going to list the most powerful women in the world, it's tough to argue against her.
Yeah, it is tough to argue against it because she has been elected for the fourth time. But looking from Germany, you think, hold on, she's not so powerful anymore. She had she's got the worst. The worst election result for the CDU, I think, since the Second World War. So, and it's going down and down and down. She's very weak. She now has to try to build up a coalition with two parties. It's as far as I follow what the coalition talks in Berlin, it's not going very well. So I don't think she is so strong. She's not strong anymore. In any case, she's on the decline.
Speaking of leaders on the decline, you made a reference there, Quentin, to Britain's own very weakened Prime Minister, which I think is a reasonable assessment. Yet there she is in second place.
Yeah, it's weird. I think this year's list actually shows, to be honest, what a bad year it is for these sort of women of power. Because if history had gone in a normal way, we would have one Hillary Clinton probably in the number one spot.
Well, unarguably, she's now holding down number 65. That's showbiz.
Yeah, and then I remember, was it last year, that, you know, number three or four was Janet Yellen, the head of the Federal Reserve in the US. Neither of them are up there at all. So the whole thing's been a bit thrown up in the air. So we've got a weakened Merkel at number one and a dramatically weakened Theresa May at number two. And with every passing day, it's almost tragic to behold that I do wonder how much longer she's going to keep going. I just wanted to make one point, though, about Angela Merkel, because these words, woman of power, came up the last time I interviewed her. And she looked at me very fiercely and she said, I don't agree with that description. I'm not a woman of power. In Germany, I'm completely constrained. I have to negotiate with my coalition partners, with the Bundestag, with the Länder, the federal states in Germany. Then I have to negotiate with the European Union states. So I'm only as powerful as my capacity to negotiate, unlike, she said, a British Prime Minister or a French President who can sort of bang the table and do what they want.
That's true in a way, but it's also a very German answer, because Germans do not like to say German in power in the same sentence.
There's still a historical nervousness there, isn't there? Mm. But that said, there is a point there, because obviously Forbes are looking at this from a global perspective, and for all that she is constrained and, as you pointed out, weakened in Germany, is she still on the global stage the most powerful woman on it?
Yes, I think so. Yes, she is. If you look at Europe, well, we will see how France will develop. UK definitely is not a power player in Europe currently because of Brexit and because of a very, inside-looking policy or no foreign policy at all. It's too much. But it's Germany, and Germany does invest more into defense. It's becoming more active in NATO. Things are developing very slowly, but of course it's taking on don't like to say it, but a powerful role in Europe.
Some other oddities on that list, I guess, Quentin. There's always oddities on these lists, but Anna Wintour, 27, Ivanka Trump at 19.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I worry to see Ivanka Trump sort of sailing in there.
I think she should be higher. I think she's very powerful. Yeah. 19 is not very.
She's powerful in that she obviously has unfettered access to the President of the United States, but there is increasingly large question mark over how powerful he actually is.
Well, but they still have the jobs they have, so they are powerful.
Yeah. But on the subject, I guess the Anna Wintour thing, I arched my eyebrow at slightly, but
that she's so high or so low?
She's so high, 27, yeah. For a magazine editor. Yeah, but Stephanie, I did wonder, are entertainers in the list? Are they? I can't decide whether they're marked unfairly down or unfairly up. Beyoncé Knowles at 50, Taylor Swift at 85. Now, you can argue that they are both merely pop singers, but they are both pop singers with an absolutely colossal global audience.
Exactly, and if I think of my daughters, they're absolutely dependent on them. They're looking every 5 minutes at Instagram. And whatever Taylor Swift is saying, sorry, I shouldn't know the name better, is absolutely pivotal for them. So yes, the influence is huge. And I think also Anna Wintour, because she is heading the most important fashion magazine, has a lot of power over what women think, what they are interested in. And something, a comment she makes, really can shift opinion.
I think you need to make a slight distinction there between the word power and the word influence, because maybe power is actually the wrong word. And if you look at it as influence, then absolutely right. Mm-hmm. I think these media stars and so on do have enormous influence, and through Twitter, through Facebook, social media, but may not really, when push comes to shove, be women of power as such.
Final thought on this one, Quentin. Jacinda Ardern, the new Prime Minister of New Zealand, up to 38. How powerful can the Prime Minister of New Zealand be, really?
I suspect not that powerful. The trouble is with all these lists, they tend to be a bit instant, a bit trendier. Oh my goodness, there's a new name on the block. We better have them in quick. And I think they're a bit of a nonsense at the end of the day. But having said that, role models are important to Stephanie's daughters.
I don't think I've ever... Have either of you ever been on a list like this? A list of any sort of most or least powerful or influential? I don't think I have.
No, I'm afraid not. I used to look for the sort of the editors or who crept into the list. My name was never there.
We are going to take a short break on that existentially terrifying note. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Stephanie Bolton and Quentin Peel. Coming up next, France lifts its state of emergency, or does it?
For November, Monocle heads into the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, boldly going beyond the chocolate box with a big old trip to Switzerland. Uphill and down valley, our team trekked and tobogganed to bring you the extra thick cream of the crop. The cities and villages, designers, chefs, businesses and opportunities that set these fair cantons apart. Elsewhere in the pages, it's business as usual, which means highly unusual. Where else are you going to get a report from Iceland's strategic airbase? A tour bus diary from the Coptic Pope as he plays to packed crowds of believers in Melbourne? A report from the growing independence movement in the Faroe Islands? Or a trip to meet the artists ensuring Jeddah stays Saudi Arabia's most liberal city? Some extra cherries on the cake come in the form of the tour of two halves of the Yves Saint Laurent museums in Paris and Marrakesh, an absolutely gorgeous house in Tasmania that we're all fighting over to stay at, and a whistle-stop tour of the International Baking Renaissance. Now there's a sentence that makes the cake to put the cherry on in the first place. Full circle. Switzerland's wonders never cease. Monocle's November issue is out now.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Stephanie Bolton and Quentin Peel. Now, it is a little less than 2 years since France was placed under a state of emergency following terrorist attacks in and around Paris that killed 130 people. Little more than 2 years, actually, now that I get the date straight in my head. That state of emergency has now been lifted and/but has been replaced by a new anti-terror law, which in many important respects does not look all that different from a state of emergency. Stephanie, is this the French state merely awarding itself permanently what should have been temporary powers?
Well, it does look so in certain areas, but what is interesting that there was a poll apparently recently that confirmed that 80% of the population actually say this is what we want. And I was in Paris last in Easter this year, and I found it quite sad, actually, the intensity of security everywhere. And the fact is, there have been so many terror attacks, and people is rightly very, very worried about their safety every day, their everyday safety, whether in Paris or in Marseille or somewhere in Nice, somewhere else. So it is understandable that people crave for more security. But then the question is, interfering into civil rights, into data protection, all these things, do these measures bring the safety and security people want? That's the big question.
Quentin, do we have an answer there as to which the people of France are picking in that always tense balance between freedom and security?
I think at the moment they're clearly pricking security. I mean, Emmanuel Macron, when he was campaigning to become president, sounded quite strong on the freedom side and was saying, we've got to get rid of this state of emergency. Almost as soon as he actually became president, he started going slightly slow on that. France does have probably the most draconian security laws of any country in Europe, because they date all the way back to the Algerian War of Independence. Having said that, they've also faced by far the greatest number of attacks, of terrorist attacks in recent times. So that's understandable. There is a, I mean, there's a very healthy debate going on about whether this is going over the top, and I think that's important. I think that what they've got to get right is the balance between security that affects everybody equally and security that is seen to be very skewed towards Muslims, mosques, and so on, which might really alienate the middle of the road, peaceful Muslim population, which is a very important one to win over.
Well, that's the question there, I guess, Stephanie. That 80% of French people you mentioned, is that likely to be, do we think, the 80% of white non-Muslim French people who think this isn't likely to be their problem?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, there is the danger, because one of the measures apparently is that you can set up kind of buffer zones or security zones ad hoc. The police has powers to go in and say, so we seal off this area now because there's an immediate threat. And there's people saying, well, if that is not handled correctly, that will probably be in Muslim, mainly Muslim areas, and this is stigmatizing the Muslim population, which itself then will contribute to this community feeling alienated, and this will not improve relationship between or the cohesion of society, and that's a big threat.
When a democratic society reacts like this, Quentin, is it by definition a capitulation to terrorism, or is it merely a sane and sensible adjustment to events?
It's a very difficult balancing act. I think at the moment that 80% figure tells us that that is what the population feels they need. People have felt very destabilized by these terrorist attacks, and particularly the more recent variety, the sort of, you know, lorries or cars being used as weapons. The fact that it seems to be that much easier for, you know, lone wolves to just get out there. And therefore, I think that there is a sense of nervousness. I mean, London is perhaps not a good city in which to look at that, because Londoners are amazingly laid back on the whole about security. But you travel to Brussels today, or Stephanie was talking about Paris, and you see these armed soldiers everywhere on the railway stations and so on the metro stations. And that's quite
scary. But you obviously have to question, how much can they do? Is this only to give an impression that actually everything is under control? And how much can they do at the end of the day? Not much.
Well, is there, Stephanie, a political calculation going on here from the French government as well, that if you're seen to be taking a hard line, then it does rather cut off at the knees the likes of Marine Le Pen and the Front National?
Yes, of course. And of course, I mean, it's understandable that the government of Emmanuel Macron needs this. Is, if you look at the list, what are the priorities for voters was before the election back in May, it was terrorism and security. So he needs to find a response to that. And obviously he wants to strike a balance, but people is less and less looking at civil liberties and more into their personal security and safety.
Is this a new normal for France then, Quentin? Because it does. The other tricky thing is, once you crack down, once you restrict civil liberties, or once you arrogate increased powers to the security services, it takes real nerve to wind that back.
I think it does. I mean, in a way, I'm quite surprised that they've chosen this moment to relax the state of emergency, which they've rolled over again and again and again. Because precisely at this moment, when IS is very much on the back foot, or effectively sort of defeated in Iraq and Syria, that's the moment at which they've been going out and targeting distant targets, like in Europe, or indeed, as we've seen most recently, in America. And so it is a time when I think there's going to be, have to be, quite tight security for, let's say, a year. But I think that our populations at the end of the day are going to say, we've had enough of this. We want more normal life. We want our data privacy back, as they would say in Germany very much. Or we want our freedom of movement back, as they'd say in Britain.
Well, let's move along finally tonight to the tentative attempts by Finnair to publicly address the delicate equation that underpins all air travel, that of fuel versus weight. Finnair, like all airlines, imposes restrictions on how much luggage passengers carry, but has avoided the trickier issue of how much luggage passengers constitute. Until now, check-in staff at Helsinki have been asking passengers to volunteer to step onto scales to more accurately calibrate their estimates. Quentin, are they on a strange path here?
It certainly makes me feel a bit wobbly. It's bad enough having my wife telling me I'm overweight rather than having a sort of public shaming. But are they actually saying, get on there with all your luggage? Say, well,
I think
actually,
so, yeah. And they ask you if you want to do it. It's not, they can't force you.
Yeah,
so
it is genuinely interesting what they're learning about the patterns of various flights in various directions. I mean, is there a legitimate argument for this, Stephanie? Can they be usefully learning things that will save them money? You inevitably end up thinking of that story of American Airlines in the 1980s. This may be apocryphal, but who deduced that if they removed one olive from every salad, that would save them, you know, $50,000 a year?
Yeah, well, it's this whole business of cheap carriers, and I obviously take often cheap carriers to go back and forth to Germany. It's a madness, and especially with the very cheap carriers. The other day I traveled to Poland, and flying back, there was almost a congestion to get onto the plane because of all these people who were opening their hand luggage and trying to take things out because their hand luggage was too heavy and putting it into their pockets. So it's almost there's less loss of dignity in all this. And I was reflecting on this. If I would go on the scale, and then thought, okay, if it's with with luggage, then no one will know what's my weight and what's my luggage weight.
You just told me I have a suitcase full of gold. That will be it. My favourite story in this regard, this was told to me by somebody whose word I trust, was that they were on an assignment flying to somewhere rickety, and their cameraman was told that he would have to pay an extra surcharge for his flak jacket, which they are very heavy. I have flown with them myself and just managed to get under the baggage allowance, but he was charged the extortionate rate they charge for excess baggage, and he said he wasn't going to pay it, and what he did was put it on and just wore it on the plane, because of course they cannot charge you excess baggage for clothes that you happen to be wearing. And you've got to admire that, because I think if I recall rightly, it was quite a long flight to Baghdad or somewhere, and I have also flown on an aeroplane while wearing a flak jacket, not for that reason, but it is incredibly uncomfortable. Quentin, what have you ever tried to take liberties with what you were able to check in terms of...
Well, I am certainly inclined to stuff my pockets, because that's because I always carry too many books, so I end up with, you know, sort of pockets full of books. My wife was just saying, actually, they're very good jackets. What you want to get are the hunting jackets, you know, the sort that you can put weapons in and dead birds in the pockets and everything.
I think most airlines have issues with weapons and dead birds.
Yes, no, I'm talking about the empty pockets that would normally have those things, and then you can fill them up with your books.
Stephanie, do you have tactics for maximising what you can get away with taking on planes?
It's actually quite handy if you travel with kids, because they all have the right to one big hand luggage suitcase, and they don't usually need so much clothes, so 50% of their suitcase is full of my stuff, so that's...
But
that's
wouldn't they insist on having sort of ghastly pink ones with wheels?
I don't care.
So you repurpose the children as couriers?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I quite like that. I just get really mesmerised by the... And I was thinking about this. I came back from a story for Monocle in Italy a couple of weeks ago, and it's not a long flight. It's an hour and a half, if that, from Bologna back to London. And the people you see getting on, carrying enough provisions to sustain themselves on a voyage to the South Pole is just extraordinary.
It was a long tradition, you know. I remember taking trains from Italy 30 years ago and finding people with the most wonderful collection of salami and chickens and so on, all going from Italy to Germany as if total starvation would greet them at the other end.
But that's a train. I mean, that's legitimate. This is a 90-minute flight.
Well, what about travelling on Aeroflot, which I used to have to do from Russia, where they fed you nothing for about 6 hours?
I've eaten the Aeroflot food. You should have been grateful for that. In fact, I suspect they probably charge you extra to feed you nothing. Apologies, Aeroflot. if you're listening. It was a long time ago. I'm sure the food has improved dramatically. That does bring us to the end of today's show. I'm pretty sure it hasn't. Quentin Peel and Stephanie Bolton, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Dallana. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. There's more music next. At 1900, Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist. There's more on the day stories, big stories, that is, on the daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you very much for listening.